Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of This Week in Doom. Joining me, as always, is the green chicken himself, Doomberg. Hello, mate. How are you?
Grant, doing great. I can tell by the video that you are back in the Cayman Islands, which is...
I am back in the Cayman Islands. How about that?
A precious rarity for you. Where have you been, and where has the world taken you?
Oh, I've been all over the place. I went to Vegas. I went to Australia to spend some time with my daughter, which was wonderful. I went to Tasmania to play golf and didn't see a single snake, which was a huge relief. And then I went to, I've been like, where have I been since then?
You went to the Masters.
I went to the Masters. And then I went to Toronto to do some filming up there and caught the early spring in Toronto. I had 3 days of glorious weather in April, which you don't often get in Toronto. So I've been a very lucky man. How about you? Just hanging around the coop?
Hanging around the coop. You know, I had a nice spring break trip with the Doomberg team and the celebration of our 1 year anniversary of going paid. And so it's been a pretty incredible year, as you know. And,
crazy, and so we took 1 year already.
We took a week to celebrate, but we took pride in the fact that our readers had no idea. So we kept the machine going and it's just been fun. You know, I was joking with you off the air that it's not, when your work is play, it's never, you don't really need a vacation. A vacation is just, you're going somewhere else for a while. And kind of still doing the same stuff. So it's kind of fun, but it was good. Happy to get back at it. You know, happy to see spring come. And we too, where we live, had this run of balmy weather, and then the next day it was snowing. So what are you going
to do? Yeah, welcome to the upper Midwest, my friend. Welcome to the upper Midwest. So you're back with a bang, with a piece you wrote this week, which I thought would be a perfect thing to talk about, which was, you titled it Uniting States. And it kind of feeds into this massive surge in commentary around the de-dollarization narrative, which is something that, you know, plenty of people have been talking about for a while now. It's been happening kind of in plain sight, but around the fringes. But there's been a noticeable uptick in the amount of people commentating on it and acknowledging it. And there's been a huge amount of news flow in and around this story, which is really getting almost impossible to ignore. I did a conversation with Ben Hunt on the Narrative Game about this recently, which was fascinating, as it always is to talk to Ben about it. And it just struck me with your piece that it was a subject that does bear further discussion. So why don't we kick off with Uniting States and talk about that piece and what you wrote and the kind of framework behind it and why you wrote it, more importantly.
Yeah, let's start with the last question. You know, when I was a child, I have a memory of reading 1984, you know, shortly after I had learned to read. And anybody who's read 1984 as a child, that was a mistake, because it stains you for the rest of your life.
I was the same.
and B, I have a distinct memory of saying to myself, I am a free-thinking person. And when the time comes where I have the sense that I'm bathing in propaganda, I intend to be as free-thinking as I can be, because actually, not to get too philosophical, but it really is what it means to be human, to think, you know, for your own self and not necessarily believe what you're told because the people telling it have some authority over you. And that's a sort of context for this piece, which is, you know, with this intelligence leak, this bizarre story that broke in the last 10 days or so, and the high profile arrest of some 21-year-old kid. And, you know, the thing that really struck me is the entire sort of standard news organizations, all their story was around the crime that this kid committed, not the crimes that the kid revealed. And, you know, what's the difference between a whistleblower and a traitor? And it's a fine line. And the intelligence that they leaked seemed to indicate that the war perhaps was not going as well as the stories being sold internally. So with that propaganda background, and you wrote a brilliant piece on propaganda for Things That Make It Go Hoom not that long ago, it occurred to us that there might be a sea change occurring in the Middle East, and it's not being covered in the way that you know, there's the truth, and then there's what we're told, and then there's something in between. And what we're told about what's going on in the Middle East, in our view, is distinctly different than what's actually occurring on the ground. And so Uniting States was an attempt to piece together a series of news articles from a variety of sources, Western and Middle Eastern, and to perhaps sketch a vision as to what might be going on the ground and what it might mean for the oil markets predominantly. And then secondarily, this move against the US dollar, you know, especially in the energy trade. And we started by telling the story of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's grand Vision 2030 plan of spending trillions of dollars, trillions with a T, to remake the entire Saudi economy. And we talked about, you know, the Red Sea Project, which is just this opulent tourist town that they're building out of the desert with, you know, 8-star hotels and an international airport and all this stuff. And these trillions of dollars have to come from the profits of the oil and gas sector. And as the cost to produce oil continues to increase, the price that the swing producers of oil need in order to maintain their sort of domestic objectives is ever increasing. And this is known internally in Saudi Arabia as a Saudi first policy. And we questioned in the piece, well, if Saudi Arabia is just now first, who used to be? and the OPEC plus cut sort of lays bare the answer to that rather uncomfortable question, which is it used to be the U.S. and MBS is of the mindset that it is no longer the U.S. And, you know, Donald Trump, to be fair, pulled out of the Middle East largely, and Biden and MBS have a notoriously difficult relationship. And so this isn't sort of a partisan analysis, but into the power vacuum that the U.S. has left behind swooped in China. And suddenly we see peace breaking out in the Middle East. China's negotiated a detente of sorts between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Magically, the war in Yemen seems to be wrapping up. And we talked about how Middle Eastern news organizations were plastered with joyous reunification videos and pictures of prisoners of war being exchanged, which was brokered by the Red Cross. And if you view Yemen as sort of a proxy war between the U.S. and Iran, that war wrapping up is an interesting observation. Iran and Qatar suddenly have reestablished ties. You know, Qatar famously quit OPEC 5 years ago. One wonders whether, you know, China is working to be seen as a unifying peacemaker. This is all in the context of the way Ukraine is explained to us versus the way these leaders believe Ukraine is going. To the American readership, it might seem peculiar the level of support that Putin is getting from his partners in the Middle East, from Russia, from Brazil, and from India, but they're being told a radically different story than we are, you know, back to truth versus propaganda versus something in between. And so when you pull it all together, you connect all the dots, the Chinese are clearly setting up a narrative, which is any future tensions in Taiwan are to be blamed on American saber rattling. And frankly, as we've pulled out, peace has broken out. You know, if you look at what we left behind in Libya, and you look at what we left behind in Iraq, and you look at what we left behind in Afghanistan, people have seen this rodeo before, and they know how, you know, they know when they're going to get bucked off of that bull. And so it's just interesting to connect these dots in a way. You know, it was a bit of a controversial piece. I think it's gone over pretty well with our subscribers, but I'm a free-thinking person, and I can see the patterns and connect the dots and understand what's really going on the ground. And back to the whole beginning of this answer with 1984, you know, especially in this day and age with intelligence agencies provably interacting with social media platforms to spin a narrative, one has to be mindful, famously, as Ben Hunt says, why am I reading this now? You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny. I was in some meetings with James Aitken a couple of months ago, and he was talking at the time to a group of people, and he said to them, look, you know, if you think back to the 70s, the last comparable time to this, along with high inflation, we also had oil shocks. We had stuff going on in the Middle East. We had a lot more friction between Middle Eastern countries. And it was Jimmy Carter, or it was Ronald Reagan, or it was always the US president that would have the photo on the White House lawn or at Camp David of bringing these warring factions together and standing there in the middle as the peacemaker. And he said to me, you know, don't be surprised if we start to see Xi Jinping take that role. If we don't start to see pictures in Beijing or other places of Xi Jinping with two warring leaders on either side of him bringing them together. And lo and behold, literally within a couple of weeks, we see this photo of the Saudis and the Iranians shaking hands. As you say, it's a clear move here to somehow try and at least stick a crampon into the moral high ground and elevate yourself to a role that can be seen as far more secular in nature rather than kind of this isolationist, communist, behind the Iron Curtain kind of stuff. And it's been fascinating to me to watch this happen. And again, as you pointed out, within the context of these intelligence leaks, I think everybody has to understand at this point in time just how big a tool social media has become for narrative spreading and for trying to present a version of the story to the people who use it. And, you know, I've had my run-ins with Elon Musk and been a staunch critic of his for a long, long time. But it's funny that, you know, since he's bought Twitter and since he claims to be all about free speech, and let's put aside any Tesla slash Musk-related free speech arguments for one moment. But I saw a couple of headlines this week, which I thought were really interesting. You know, one said that there's been a surge in climate denying since Musk took over the platform. And the other one said there's been a surge in vaccine denying since Musk took over the platform. And that's fine, right? If that's the headline, that's okay. But if you're a thinking person, the other side of that could also quite conceivably be, and given what else we know, I suspect is true, that those things were suppressed before. So it's not that there's been a sudden upsurge. It's just that the kind of the restrictions have been loosened to allow people to say whatever their views are. And it doesn't matter whether you agree with them or not. This stuff is out there and people believe it. So it's been fascinating to watch how this kind of social media stranglehold on information has been kind of played out in the public eye, thanks to Twitter and thanks to Musk and thanks to the guys like Matt Taibbi, who are kind of trying to shine a light on how this whole thing works. And I thought that, aligned with your piece, did a really, really good job of helping people perhaps understand a little bit more about what's going on behind the scenes here.
Yeah, and, you know, again, it's one thing to pride yourself on not just swallowing the propaganda, but as an investor, and, you know, your listeners are global investors, you know, you have a global audience, you know, understanding to your best ability what the actual truth on the ground is imperative in order to understand the chess pieces on the board and how they're likely to move. And so, you know, to Elon Musk's credit, I think he has shined a light on what I think is an amazing scandal. Like, only the most hardened progressive partisan can now say that somehow Twitter wasn't being selectively used for political purposes by members of the left. And that doesn't make the rest of Elon's history, you know, acceptable or palatable. But in this narrow regard, he has done a service by highlighting this. And of course, Elon being who he is, you know, the relationship between Taibbi and Elon is now ruptured because of Substack rolling out this Twitter competitor Notes, which we're on actively. And it's kind of a fun to be in the early days of something like that. But nonetheless, you know, it's incumbent upon investors, which is why I think our piece is relevant. What does the reality on the ground reflect for the potential energy price, you know, Monte Carlo simulation of possibilities in the next 3, 6, 9, and 12 months? And learning the reality on the ground is going to serve you far better than swallowing the propaganda and trading that. And so our view is Saudi Arabia, as we open the piece, needs higher oil prices. MBS doesn't care about Joe Biden's political future. And in order to have the best possibility of maintaining a suitably high floor under the price of oil, MBS has deduced, in partnership with China, that a unified and peaceful Middle East that can act in coordination is his best shot at that. And you'll notice this 1.5 million barrel a day OPEC plus cut that was a surprise announcement a couple of weeks ago. That was incredibly unified. This is probably the most unified we've seen OPEC in a very long time. And one of the things we hinted at in the piece, if we see Qatar, which is sort of considered aligned with the US, suddenly rejoining OPEC, that would be a milestone to look for. That would surprise the market in our view. And if we saw that headline cross, we would be deeply bullish commodities.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's already been rapprochement between Qatar and the Arab states. We've seen that in recent weeks, that they're being kind of welcomed back into the fold. Not OPEC just yet, but I think you're absolutely right. You know, it's been fascinating to watch this play out. And I thought the point you made about Saudi first was such an interesting one. I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right. If you're saying, okay, now it's Saudi first, that does imply that that hasn't been the case. And, you know, like all these things that we've had in terms of the way the world's changed since inflation has gotten higher and rates have started going up, everything's 180-degree reversal. You know, it's actually not that difficult to understand what's likely to happen if these things play out the way they are suggesting. You know, if deflation and lower rates forever led to what we've seen in terms of asset prices, in terms of house prices, stock markets, et cetera, if you take a 180-degree turn in interest rate policy and inflation, we know what happens, right? Bond prices get sold, stocks get sold, house prices come off, mortgages go up. We've seen all that. And lower oil prices versus higher oil prices is exactly the same idea. If oil prices are going to be higher forever, it just feeds that inflation narrative. And a lot of people are still sitting there waiting for this pivot, you know? I think the more you listen to central bankers, the more you see prints like today's 10% CPI print in the UK, the more you see this stuff, the more at some point you have to realize that these guys are getting serious. You know, Christine Lagarde put out gave a speech a couple of days ago, which has been shared widely. And I think everybody should read that. It's not a long speech to read. But it's very, very clear that they understand how the world order is changing. They understand how dollar and US hegemony is under threat. They understand that they need to, in order to maintain their independence, they need to get inflation under control. And, you know, there's been people talking about central banks finding a new religion with inflation. And if that is the case, people need to wake up to the severe amount of change that is going to bring to every single corner of financial markets.
So two tidbits that are sort of interesting to observe within the context of what you just said, which I completely agree. I think it was like 10.1% print in the UK. Who's talking about a pivot when you're double-digit inflation?
Yeah.
You know, one is in the piece we quote, this amazing article in the Atlantic Council put out a piece after, you know, a rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia as negotiated by China. And they literally, it's titled, China's mediation between Saudi Arabia and Iran is no cause for panic in Washington, as though
right.
Peace breaking out in the Middle East is a cause for panic. I mean, how Orwellian, which is a word we used in the piece, which is sort of a bit of a hint as to the motivations for writing this piece, as I articulated earlier. But the second and the most interesting one was the amazing difference in the reception received by Macron in China versus Ursula von der Leyen when she was accompanying him on this visit. And, you know, President Xi rolled out the red carpet for Macron, and she was relegated to, you know, basically the coat check area in the back. It's just really amazing. And what this tells us again is that China is playing its cards very carefully. You have BSF basically relocating out of Germany into China, another piece we're sort of running string on. France all of a sudden leaves that state visit with Xi and is saying things like, you know, we need to be careful on Taiwan and sort of was coming down on the side of China in the U.S. struggle over Taiwan. And so then when you just sort of do the global check, you have Brazil, you know, Lula out talking about why are we on the dollar and visiting and talking to China about being sort of peacemakers. Really amazing article in Foreign Affairs all of a sudden. So when you tie it all together, this article in Foreign Affairs was talking about maybe perhaps we should start thinking about a negotiated peace in Ukraine. So like one wonders whether this leak wasn't just sort of laying the battlefield with the sort of necessary preconditions for walking back some of the propaganda on how the war in Ukraine is actually going and ultimately finding a negotiated peace. So we shall see. You know, if peace is a cause for panic, that was just really fascinating. But I think what we're seeing is, you know, these global leaders aren't submitting themselves to the same level of propaganda that the average sort of U.S. consumer of news is. They have intelligence agencies. They know what's going on the ground. They have assessed U.S. leadership. They've assessed Saudi leadership. They understand what China's up to. And we're seeing people pick sides. And is the U.S. waning in its international influence? It's still obviously a military superpower. We're probably closer to the camp that de-dollarization is a bit overhyped and the U.S. dollar is going to be a prominent currency for a very long period of time. But at the margins, and certainly in the energy markets, we do think that the sort of the pattern of events that we've seen in the last month point to a unified Middle East, waning of U.S. influence, waxing of Chinese influence, and what that ultimately means for commodities and the energy sector is something that, you know, investors need to understand.
Well, let's stick on that topic of de-dollarization because it is, as I said at the top of the show, it is something that is just, you can't avoid it these days, which I find interesting in and of itself. You know, what I've been surprised about, I guess in some ways, but I probably shouldn't be, is just how entrenched everybody is in their views about this. You know, and for the longest time, there's been a minority of people saying, you know, that the dollar's days are done and the dollar's going to go away as a reserve currency. And, you know, they'll point to history and every other reserve currency, and they certainly have that argument on their sides. And the other side has been, don't be ridiculous, the dollar is not going to get supplanted anytime soon, if ever, because there's just no competitive alternative. Yeah, both of which are absolutely right. But what's, I guess, fascinated me is how, as the news flow has changed, and it has noticeably changed, and a lot of the handshakes that were being made behind the scenes over the last 10 years, are starting to happen on the front page of the FT and the front page of the Wall Street Journal now. No matter which side you're on in this debate about dollar hegemony and dollar reserve currency status, it's impossible not to acknowledge that things are changing. And so, you know, for me, you know, I try to keep an open mind about these things as I do with everything. And I think there's no point in digging your heels in on one side of the argument or the other. But it's been fascinating to me to see how, with an undeniably escalated news flow and a series of leaders being far more forthright about the challenge they think the dollar poses, particularly in the wake of the Treasury sanctions against Russian central bank assets. We've had Yellen acknowledge that that may have been a mistake. We've had Christine Lagarde in her speech talk about, you know, weaponizing the dollar and mentioning sanctions particularly. It's absolutely clear to me that this narrative is changing. And if you accept that, if you accept that the narrative is changing, if you accept that people are actively looking for ways to mitigate their exposure to the risk that being confined only to the dollar imposes upon you, then you have to realize that the world is changing. And it may not happen quickly, but every single deal that gets done outside the dollar, people need to understand is another set of dollars that isn't needed anymore. And that's the thing here. Whether the dollar is the reserve currency or not is fine, but how much of that reserve currency do people need? How big a deficits will the US be able to run? Because people need X amount of dollars. And if that X amount starts to shrink with the US finances in the state they're in, that creates a severe problem. And I think the dogmatism around this issue is incredibly short-sighted. I think people need to open up their eyes to what's actually happening here and not just say, well, it's not going to happen. You know, it's a complete red herring. We're not going to de-dollarize anytime soon. Because what that suggests to me is the dollar's not going to go away as a reserve currency. And I agree with that. But as I said, I think less and less of them are going to be needed. And that is a creeping challenge that somewhere faces a tipping point that kind of kicks back to the US's ability to run its finances the way it does. And I think that's a problem. What do you think about that, Dumi? You and I haven't really spoken about this.
As you're talking, I have the Financial Times pulled up, and there's a picture of Lula with Xi in Beijing from Friday. And the headline is, Lula vows partnership with China to, quote, balance world geopolitics. And I'm sure you've read this piece. And it's really eye-opening that, and again, if you just count up the number of people in Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, so the BRICS countries. Then you mix in a unified Middle East, as we said in the piece. Like, the reports are there. Saudi Arabia and Iran have both applied to join BRICS organization. You're talking, what, 3 to 4 billion people and 50% of world oil production? So, you know, roughly, I don't know, like, what is OPEC plus 30 and change, maybe. You know, Brazil, 30% of their economy relies on fertilizer imports from Russia. Brazil has famously stayed neutral on the Russia-Ukraine war, does not participate in the sanctions. You know, this narrative when the sanctions were rolled out, and to, you know, Luke Grohman's credit, and we wrote a pretty early piece in this regard as well about, hey, I'm not so sure this is going to work or is the wisest policy, and the amount of heat that we took back then when we were at the sort of the peak of the propaganda. Much of what Luke said and what we wrote and what you were saying has kind of turned out to be true. Like, my particular favorite is this Western techno egotism that somehow between China, India, and Russia, they would be unable to keep energy flowing. I mean, this is a radical underestimation of the amount of money and people that are invested in hydrocarbon technology development in China and India alone. And their motivation to do so is very clear. And so same with Brazil. You know, Brazil has a very, very large national oil companies are embroiled in scandal, but I mean, they have technology embedded inside their country that they can use. It's very bizarre, this notion that we should be systematically underestimating our geopolitical enemies, otherwise we're somehow unpatriotic or Putin puppets or pick your favorite sort of online name-calling game that goes on. You should be assessing your geopolitical opponents with the maximum amount of realism and maybe even rounding up so that you can be pleasantly surprised when there are perhaps shown to be paper tigers. But to your question of de-dollarization, I don't think there's ever going to be a world where the Western financial markets are transacting in anything other than the US dollars. The question becomes, what will the rest of the world be doing? How does that partition look like? Is it a fragmented set of competitors to the dollar, one-off deals like you've talked about? Or do the BRICS countries, and perhaps in collaboration with the Middle East, form some form of a currency that they use to settle their trade imbalances? And there'll be, you know, pipelines between the two sort of systems. But I don't think there's a world where I will stop transacting in U.S. dollars. I live in the U.S. I'm a taxpayer. I'm a law-abiding citizen. As I've said on other podcasts, if they outlawed the private ownership of gold, I'd be turning in my gold. I don't want to live a life breaking the law. But the heart of the argument on Twitter is that it's either or. And I think we're both in the something's changing. It's not black or white, but it's getting grayer. And with these ever-increasing series of headlines that fit this pattern that we tried to connect in uniting states, it gets a little grayer in our view. And I don't know what that looks like, but it doesn't look like what it was yesterday. And it's going to look different tomorrow.
Well, and it's change. It's change, right? And markets don't like change. And we as humans don't like change. And we're not very good at accepting it and adapting to it. But this is a major change. Just the idea that people would be, you know, openly talking, leaders of countries would be openly talking about trying to sideline the dollar. That's a change. That would not have happened 10 years ago. There is absolutely no chance Lula would have come out and said what he said 10 years ago. There is no chance that she would have been actively trying to set up these payment networks. There's no chance, absolutely none, that the Saudis would be so flagrant in terms of their kind of rejection of the US administration and their throwing in their lot with states deemed as enemies to the United States. It just wouldn't have happened. So if nothing else, I think people have to understand that something has changed. And if something has changed, it means things are going to be different. They're going to be different around the energy markets. They're going to be different around the currency markets. They're going to be different around the gold market. You know, things have changed. And I think everybody needs to just open their mind up to that idea and at least think through, okay, if these relationships have changed, what does that likely mean for all the things that we wish would stay the same? Because I think if you do that mental exercise, you'll realize that there's some really important shifts are going to happen here that are going to have force you to rethink a lot of sacred cows that you thought you'd never have to worry about before.
So let's talk about one, which we were joking about before we hit record, which is if you go back to our sort of view of the world, which is energy is the master resource. We've spent a lot of time in the West putting up with and playing footsie with sort of radical Malthusian environmentalists and their global warming alarmism. And we were talking about how, you know, snooker, the World Snooker Championship is going on right now. And at the Crucible earlier this week, a Just Stop Oil protester, you know, jumped out of the stands and got onto a snooker table and opened up a bag of orange powder and made a fine mess and disrupted the tournament. And you know, we've put up with such nonsense probably for too long, but this sort of anti-fossil fuel movement in the US and in the West and obviously Europe and the UK, the fact that we have 10% inflation in the UK and the UK has basically unilaterally disarmed itself in the energy wars is no coincidence. And one of the casualties of this entire move against the dollar might be that the West finally decides to get serious about energy policy, because ultimately, this is all about energy. Energy stirs geopolitics, and we are disarming while the rest of the world is arming up. And the reason we're disarming is because we've allowed these children, really, to dictate policy. And so, you know, the loudest voices get a disproportionate share. Biden knows better. When oil and gasoline went to $5 a gallon in the U.S., he panicked and emptied the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And in fact, this OPEC cut is because MBS allegedly was upset that the U.S. had decided not to refill that petroleum reserve. Which is all the more ironic that Saudi Arabia wants them to refill it. If we're about to go to war with China, you'd think we'd want to have those reserves topped up a little bit. You can't really make it up when you think about it. But ultimately, you know, we've written so much about energy. If we got serious about energy, it would only strengthen our geopolitical hand, which is something we've been saying for a long time, even in the context of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And so perhaps a long shot prediction is the response to this move against the dollar by Western politicians as we finally shed ourselves of this nonsense. And then this is why your comment about the reports that you see that, oh, you know, there's denialism is surging now that Elon Musk owns Twitter. This might, again, why am I reading this now? Well, maybe because the time for having the luxury of worrying about our carbon emissions has come and gone. And if we continue down this path of kneecapping our own domestic production, We're handing more and more market control to OPEC Plus, and we will have to suffer the consequence of that, which include massive inflation. And so, you know, these are all sort of connected things, and it's fascinating to sort of observe them.
No, it is. And no one's written better or more profusely about energy and markets and pricings than you. In fact, you wrote another piece a couple of weeks ago, I think, or maybe a week ago, called Guilt by Association, which we should talk about at this point. But before we do, did you see there was a clip of someone being interviewed by one of these, there was a panel of experts in Congress or the Senate testifying on climate change. And there was a farmer who was also brought in to testify. And he said to this panel of experts, he said, you know, what percentage of the Earth's atmosphere is made up of carbon dioxide? Did you see this?
Yeah.
And you've got six or seven people down this line who all are dumbfounded by this question. Eventually they go down the line and one says five, another one says, what he said. Another one says, I'll go six. Another one says, I'll take seven. And another one says, I'll take the high end. Eight. Like it's some kind of game that we're playing here to see who can get closest to the pin. And, you know, the farmer comes back and says it's 0.04.
Yeah, 400 parts per million.
Yeah. And so, and if you can be that far out as someone who's testifying at what a danger carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, it does make you wonder just how captured this whole discussion has been.
Wow. Not to get too far off course, but this gets back to something we've written about on a couple of occasions, not as the thrust of a piece, but as a toss aside in a piece, which is the manipulation of units, right? So I told the story in one of the pieces of a radio station when I was in college, and they were bragging about the power of their radio station. In a big booming voice, the narrator says 50,000 milliwatts of power. So yeah, carbon dioxide is 400 parts per million. 400 parts per million, of course, is 400,000 parts per trillion. And it's only a matter of time. Well, this is, again, why oil discoveries are quoted in barrels and oil spills are quoted in gallons.
Gallons, yeah.
You get it just every time. And so this is the same phenomenon going on here. But, you know, so the piece, Guilt by Association, which you referenced, is this amazing situation in the U.S. where because all of the growth is coming in the Permian Basin, and the Permian Basin wells have an awful lot of natural gas that comes along with the oil, which is now trapped regionally because we don't have pipelines, and we don't have pipelines because we've let the children set the political stage for us. You have natural gas trading at the Waha hub for $1 per million BTU. And over in California, Gavin Newsom, no friend of the fossil fuel industry, is suffering under $9 per million BTU natural gas. And what is he doing, of course, is he is flailing about saying that there's market manipulation and anti-competitive behavior. How could it be that natural gas is nine times the price in California at the SoCal hub than it is in Texas? Well, the answer is plain. You haven't built the infrastructure. And so, in fact, the lack of pipeline infrastructure to get natural gas out of the Permian in many ways is one of the key factors that's constraining our potential to grow oil, which Biden claims to desperately want and need. And so it's all sort of interconnected. The CEO of Pioneer was on Robert Bryce's great podcast, the Power Hungry podcast, a couple of weeks ago. And I listened very carefully as he described what was constraining growth in the Permian. And there are things like water management and sand for a province. But the thing he was concentrating on was lack of offtake capacity for natural gas. And, you know, you can't flare it. I mean, people have flared it. They don't want to vent it. The U.S. has a goal to reduce flaring. So I should say 1 billion cubic feet per day is burned in the fields today in the U.S. Natural gas, which was selling for $100 per million BTU in Europe just last summer, is being burned because it's a nuisance. And this is how much energy the U.S. is sitting on. And if it ever got serious about actually implementing a thoughtful energy policy, it would be a superpower. Like it is a superpower. It would be a dominant one if it actually had practical leadership on the energy issue, which is, as you know, we've written that piece in different ways probably 50 times. And we got another one in the hopper.
Right.
But until we get serious about it, we think we have to keep writing about it and demonstrating. And, you know, the comments to these pieces, especially Guilt by Association, people just don't know these things. They don't know that natural gas is selling for $1 in Texas and it was selling for $100 in Europe. Okay, why is that? And how could we prevent that in the future? And why can't we have a normalized price of $3 everywhere in the world? Well, we could if we all got serious about it. And by the way, $1 per million BTU natural gas is the equivalent of $6 a barrel oil.
Oil, yeah.
It's crazy. But you have Newsom, who's running for president, out saying that California is being gouged by natural gas producers. And one wonders how much longer we could play this foolish game of politics instead of actually thinking about the first principles of physics and deciding accordingly.
Well, look, again, the problem is, and we keep coming back to this, the problem is the control of the narrative. And unfortunately, the narrative in the media is not designed to take an independent, unbiased look at something and tell the story. It's to take the story and turn it into a story, i.e. a story that they think will appeal to their readers. And that we saw this with the Fox Dominion lawsuit getting settled yesterday, right? That we know what our readers and our listeners want to hear. So how do we twist the story into a story that they'll want? And until that stops, and I don't see how that stops, to be honest with you, it's impossible to see how people get educated about these things. It's impossible to see. No one's going to see, you know, the chart you put in that Guilt by Association piece of SoCal against Waha natural gas is shocking. You know, it's absolutely shocking. But only people with a Bloomberg who look at that arcane cross trade are going to see that chart. That's not something that's going to be flashed on the news, because if it was, you don't need to understand energy policy to look at a chart like that and go, well, hang on a second, that can't be right. You know, these are two oil prices in the same country. How is that even possible?
Let's describe the key element of that chart. So in December, the price of natural gas at the SoCal hub reached $55 per million BTU. And 2 weeks later, the price of natural gas at Waha went negative.
Yeah.
For the same molecule in the same country. And that can only be because we can't get the molecule from one place to the other. Like this, there's no other conclusion. And as you say, once you see that chart, you can't unsee it. And that chart is the piece, of course. On the flip side, on the positive side, very bullish for Bloomberg. There's no shortage of such opportunities for us to leverage our Bloomberg. And there's, as you know, Bloomberg is a powerful machine. And so, like, in all seriousness, no, I do think this rise of the alternative media is because you got to go to a Bloomberg or to a Luke Grohman or to a Grant Williams or pick your favorite content creator who's doing well, a Steph Pomboy, to see the real data, to connect the dots, and then make decisions accordingly, right? And so that chart is staggering, as you said, and it's all available. You can go and reproduce it on your Bloomberg. You just have to know where to look. And so knowing where to look and showing people the data is sort of what makes Bloomberg fun and what makes us successful. And so ironically, we're arguing to put ourselves out of business. If suddenly our politicians became sane, there'd be far less demand for our product. And so we'd have to reinvent ourselves.
Well, I don't think that's going to be a problem anytime soon. But the surprising thing about that chart, because, you know, oftentimes when you look at as many charts as you and I do, they tend to, you know, go along and occasionally one will rise faster than the other. But the thing that amazed me about that chart was the prices were literally going in the opposite directions at the same time. You know, as SoCal was soaring, Waha was actually plummeting. It wasn't just not keeping up with it. It was actively going in the other direction. And that has to tell you that something is so screwed up with this thing, it's just impossible to deny it.
Yeah, and of course, what was going on is there was a significant demand for oil, which meant production was going full throttle in the Permian, which meant they were producing way more natural gas, which meant they had no place to put it. And at the same time, there was a cold snap in California and they needed gas and they don't, you know, because of their own foolish policies, don't have pipelines that connect to the rest of the U.S. grid. Worse than that, of course, California imports its oil, not just gas. It imports its oil. And its refining capacity, we had written another piece called Eggheads, where we talked about how Newsom, again, was blaming the refiners for elevated gasoline prices in California. Well, I mean, what state has been more at war for as long as California has with refiners than any other state in the country? And it's, I mean, why would you be in the refining business in California? So they had promised that they were going to pass this bill that would cap the profits of refiners. And instead, what they got was a bill that didn't do that, but just created more government measuring divisions. You know, they've created two new divisions of government that will do nothing but measure and add more friction to the commerce within the state of California. When we look at Germany and we look at California and to a slightly lesser extent, New England, you're sort of torn because, like, you see this foolhardiness. But you know people there and you like people there and their economy affects our economy and you don't wish ill on anybody. But man, how much pain do the voters need in these areas before people think that perhaps maybe we should try something different? You know, Germany following through and shutting down its last remaining nuclear power plants last week. I mean, what a treasonous act, really. I mean, there's no other way to say it. And so, you know, it is what it is. Like, we have to, all we can do as free-thinking people is articulate the insanity of it all, both in word and in number and in picture, and put it out there and build our audience as much as we can and do our best. You know, to be fair, we have a fair number of people in government who read us. We have politicians and their staffers reaching out to us. Hey, can you explain this chart to me? And we're always happy to do that because, like, in our own small way, maybe we're helping affect the narrative, you know, but it really is amazing and fascinating to see.
Well, listen, you touched upon at the top of the show, you touched upon Jack Teixeira's leaks of these documents. And so I wanted to ask you about that because we saw with Edward Snowden, these links went to The Guardian and The Guardian gave them an awful lot of airtime and made sure that the Snowden leaks were there for everybody to either read or not read as they chose, but they were put in a major publication that is read globally. The Teixeira leaks were put on a Discord server, and so much more niche. And they seem to be able to shut them down pretty effectively in terms of mainstream coverage of those leaks. I didn't see too much coverage of them that went into great detail. I certainly didn't see the splash that we saw when Snowden went public. Does that say anything about the public's appetite for this, or does it say more about the understanding on the part of the powers that be that they need to get these things under control much faster? And if so, what does that mean going forward for anyone that wants to blow the whistle on things like this?
Let me do my best Dave Collum impersonation and give you the tinfoil hat.
All right, let's hear it.
It's always kind of fun. So how convenient that these files ended up on the very social media sites that the U.S. government is fixing to crack down on. And wouldn't this be a great cause, justification for them to do so? You know, when we talk about Operation Chokepoint 2.0 and the crackdown on crypto, here you have sensitive documents miraculously obtained by some 21-year-old kid and leaked to all of the major social media sites that the government is looking to regain control over the ability to ship and shape the narrative here. And then, of course, while at the same time, I think perhaps preparing the propaganda battlefield for a surprise negotiated peace in Ukraine. And so what was leaked, of course, is that maybe things in Ukraine aren't quite going as well as Department of Defense and the administration has been describing. And boy, there's some potential that this this big push on the part of Ukraine might go terribly wrong. And in the context of all the other things we've talked about, you know, pretty soon I think we're going to be in a position where people might be surprised, which again, as an investor, you know, a surprise headline that we've reached peace in Ukraine is something that you have to put into your models as to how your investments might react to that. But we have a bit of a cynical view, which is perhaps there's a little more to the story. And, you know, they're trying to push through this Restrict Act through Congress, which is, it's got a TikTok ban wrapper on really what is an Orwellian crackdown on the entire internet. And Mike Green, to his credit, has been pounding the table that this, this bill should be opposed. And so it's kind of a nice, tidy coincidence. And by the way, they made a pretty big deal about arresting this kid, which is sort of sending a message to everybody that if you leak stuff that damages the government, we'll come after you. The government won't be held accountable. Like, interesting question for you: what would a leak have to show for the press to focus on the contents of the leak versus the guilt of the leaker? What would have to be in such documents before we would care about what was in the documents as opposed to who leaked them and how we should punish that person?
Yeah.
There was a time, if we applied the exact same media framework to the Pentagon Papers, you know, the leak of the Pentagon Papers was all about what was in the leak. And here, well,
and
it's
Watergate,
all...
Watergate, same thing, Watergate, right?
Exactly.
Same thing.
Why is it different this time? And, you know, like, if you're a government employee and you are in possession of proof of serious crimes, which is theoretically possible, right? I mean, we have checks and balances in government for this exact reason. What are you to do now? It's very clear the message is don't leak it because you'll be arrested, your life will be ruined, and helicopters will be flying over your house, and you'll be hand on head walking backwards towards a bunch of well-armed gentlemen wearing bulletproof vests. So what government employee is going to be motivated to blow the whistle on serious crimes internally? And then if there is no capacity or mechanism for government employees to blow the whistle, what does that mean for the fear that government officials might have in committing crimes in the first place? It's gone, right? And so these are serious issues, of course, but people are blinded by the partisanship. So it's their team that's currently in office. Imagine if this was Trump. Like, right. Again, this is sort of a tired trope, but if these papers were leaked and a major Trump policy was exposed to be the exact opposite of what he has been saying, do you think that the New York Times and the Washington Post would be focused on the guilt of the leaker, or would they be more focused on the content of the leak? And you know, it's just fascinating to us. And the coincidence of it with this bill making its way through Congress is a little curious to us. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I do wonder because, yeah, the Snowden leak was, what was contained in those Snowden leaks was extraordinary. And I remember at the time reading through all of it and just being amazed at what he was revealing. And simultaneously blindsided by how it, as you said, it became all about Snowden. It didn't become about, is this right or wrong? It's, was he right or wrong? And people have ultimately polarized around the character and not the leaks. I mean, I think a lot of people will probably forget a lot of the things that Snowden revealed, but they will have an opinion on whether he was a traitor or a hero.
Worse than that, they'll be normalized to it.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, we see this thing with Teixeira, and I saw in one side about the Egyptians planning to sell a boatload of arms to Russia. I saw that once, and then that was it. I didn't see it anywhere else. It wasn't kind of cross-referenced anywhere. It just kind of went away, appeared on the day and went away. And I felt like I had a really good understanding of what it was that Snowden revealed because I had the opportunity to read it all. I don't feel that way with this Teixeira stuff. I don't feel like what he revealed is out there in the public domain because I feel like I would have seen it.
It's in the domain of the leaders that we profiled.
No, precisely.
In the United States, they know what's going on. They're not subject to that propaganda. We were going to make allusion to the leak in that piece, but it's, as you know, we have a sort of a certain length we'd like to keep to, and it didn't make it into the final edit. It would just open up a rabbit hole that would be too difficult to close in a reasonable time. But they know what's in those papers. It's no surprise to them. And so when you're observing Putin and Xi and MVS's behavior, and even Brazil and India, you have to know that what they are basing their decisions on is a different set of information than what we're being fed in the West. And whatever it is that we're being fed in the West is irrelevant to their calculation. And so when you observe from our vantage point behavior that is difficult to reconcile within the context of the information we're receiving, it would behoove you to question the information we're receiving, not the sanity of the people making decisions on the other side of the world. And that was really the thrust of United States, that perhaps all is not as it's being described to us. And Lord knows, Julian Assange, same story. What we're being told and what reality is on the ground can be, and almost always is, two vastly different things. There might be very sound reasons for the propaganda campaign domestically, but, you know, trust but verify is sort of it used to be the political ethos of the democracies, quote unquote, in the West. And now it's more shut up and listen.
Right.
And excuse me, but I'm not a shut up and listen kind of guy. And maybe that gets me in trouble someday. But for now, I'm still a free thinking person.
Well, you know what? You've brought us full circle back to not only United States, but you being a free thinking chicken. So I think that's probably the perfect place to wrap this conversation up. Doomi, as always, mate, it's been educational and fun to chat with you this morning. I can't believe there's anybody out there that doesn't know how to find you, but just on the off chance that there is someone that doesn't know how to find you, let them know how they can do that.
Yeah, the best way to find me is to call 10 of your friends and tell them to go to grant-williams.com and subscribe to all of Grant's products. And then by osmosis, they will eventually learn of the green chicken and might find their way to doomberg.substack.com and find our writing on a variety of topics that we covered today.
So nicely
done. It's great. Great to see you too, and happy that you're back in Cayman on terra firma, as we would say, and looking forward to all of the great content that you've been putting out recently. It's really been spectacular. So congratulations to you as well.
All right, buddy. It's always a pleasure. We'll do it again soon. Take care. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.